Okay, so right. Should we start again?
Start again, recording again.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film and music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately. And this week, I've been to see Jin Wigmore, ably supported by Tammy Nielsen, at the Auckland Town Hall.
I'll be reporting back on my night out at Jesus Christ Part 2. And I'll also be sharing some thoughts on reviewing Thurston Moore, late of Sonic Youth, who, for better or worse, was in town this week.
Why do I feel there's a worse coming?
Okay. Yeah, you picked up on that clearly, yes.
Right, a subtle hint dropped there by Mr. McCabe. Also, the film of the book of the story that inspired the novel Moby Dick. I think I'm talking about a movie called In the Heart of the Sea.
Let's backtrack on that. The film of the story of... we'll get to that. There's going to be notes for people to follow along, I hope, with that one, because that sounds too complicated.
And a test to follow.
Excellent. I failed already. Now, you and I also both caught Michael Caine and Harvey Keitel in quite superb form in the film Youth. And should we start with that?
I think we should. It's actually a few weeks ago we saw the preview. Now.
Yes.
So let's just quickly sum up what this is about. Basically,
best of luck to you, mate.
Yeah. I know this could be a bit of a challenge. Anyway, basically, Michael Caine and Harvey Keitel are two old mates, and they go on holiday, or they meet on holiday over a number of years at a Swiss health resort, and they're getting on a bit in years, these two fellows. And this film is about what happens to these men one holiday at the resort as they reflect on their lives. It's called Youth, but it's obviously about aging. Michael plays the part of Fred, who's a composer who is well known for having produced a fantastically popular piece of work. And at the beginning of the film, the Queen's envoy arrives at the resort asking him to conduct a special royal performance, and he says no. He's got some deeply personal reasons for not wanting to do it, and that sets off a train of events that goes through the film. And Harvey Keitel is there as Mick. He's a film producer and a film writer. He's there on his, maybe it's his next or his last great work. He's got some production crew there with him, and that's what his mission is all about. And as we follow the relationship of these two men through the film, all sorts of odd and interesting other characters are interwoven into the story, are they not, Steve?
Amazing. I think interwoven is being a little bit generous, perhaps.
You mean just thrust in there?
Tossed in, dropped in, dangled around. It's hard to know really what to make of it. I think you've given a fairly fair synopsis of the story such as it is.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really do it justice, does it?
No, this is about... I suppose we should say, to help people get their heads around it, this is not a mainstream Hollywood movie. This is like an arty film you'd see at a film festival, that sort of thing, eh? Something at the Cannes Film Festival or something.
It's definitely an art house film, this one, very much so, yes. It's stylized to within an inch of its very life. It's arch, it's tart, it's very contrived in many ways. There's an awful lot that's deliberately left unsaid with the intention, presumably, of being meaningful, but sometimes just simply comes across as portentous. But it's there are moments when it's wonderfully subtle and deep. And then takes itself out in the middle of one very, very serious scene, suddenly out of nowhere. I believe it's Harvey Keitel's character, Mick, who suddenly announces, "My intestines are having a thorough clean this afternoon." So, yeah. So it's hard to get a handle on it, really.
It is. You can't. I wrote down a question to myself at times. It's sort of an essay, isn't it? It's a bit of an essay on aging and so forth.
Yes.
And how serious is the director, who's Paolo Sorrentino, by the way, how serious is Paolo being with us? At times it feels like he wants us to treat this in a deep, meaningful way, and other times he's just taking the mickey. And then sometimes I'm not quite sure which.
Yeah, it really is kind of all over the place in some ways. The direction is very, very stagey, very, very theatrical in some ways. It brings to mind Peter Greenaway, or possibly Wes Anderson. Is that kind of very, very staged, just look at it kind of direction. Just don't even think about it. Just allow the images to wash over you.
Yes. Pretty amazing images, and it's actually interesting when you go to a preview and then it's a few weeks pass and you come to review it, as we, you and I, are doing today, because I'm thinking, what are the images that stay with me after all that period of time? There's a few. the one that they put in a trailer, Steve, and you can understand why they would have put this image out to sell the film.
I think I know where you're going with this one.
We've got a stunningly beautiful Miss World who pops up in this film, right?
Yes.
And we have this scene where you see Fred and Mick, they're easing their wrinkly old bodies in a hot pool, and a naked Miss World walks, very slowly it has to be said, right up past them and slips into the water, and they are just sitting there looking absolutely stunned as mullets.
Absolutely. Remember, we only approve of nudity when the narrative calls for it.
Oh, it's absolutely in keeping. Absolutely right. Yes.
No, it's not. It's not in the slightest. It is as gratuitous a nude scene as I have seen in a film in quite some time. But then, to be fair, just about everything in this film is gratuitous.
Yeah. Well, it is gratuitous because it's a beautiful woman. In that sense, yes. But there's these two old fellas thinking, well, yeah. Those days have long gone past us by. I just want to tell you, there was one other image. For some reason, this sticks in my mind. Maybe it's because I quite like my sport. I'm not going to say too much more about the character, but there's one guy there. Remember this guy, Steve?
The morbidly obese gentleman with a tattoo of Karl Marx on his back.
Yeah, he's overweight. He seems to be hobbling around, struggling with ill health and overweight. He's wearing a dressing gown, but he's got these fans, these supporters outside the gates. They want his autograph, and he's sort of trying to figure out who he might be. And this is a scene. The scene I remember is we're all of a sudden we're looking out over a vista. And we see a tennis ball,
yes,
up in the air, going up and down, being hit almost straight up and straight down continually. And you're thinking, well, how is it getting? What's propelling it up in the air? Is it a tennis racket? Well, it's not a tennis racket. And the answer to how it gets belted up in the air tells you quite a bit about who this character might be. I won't give it away, but it wasn't who I was expecting. There are a few clues about it.
Yes.
And I thought that image of that old fella, that's something I keep with me some weeks later, I have to say.
Yes. And interesting, I don't know that he ever actually ties into the core narrative with Keitel and Kane, does he? He floats around in the background, and I'm not sure he ever actually specifically even interacts with the rest of the characters in the film.
No, it's like a little. If this was an essay, this would be just a little sidebar on the passing of youth.
It would, wouldn't it? And
yeah.
And since we're talking about the images that stick with one, if you remember toward the beginning, you mentioned this is a spa resort, and
yeah.
So we see sequences as the days start up of almost like production lines of old age pensioners on moving on like horizontal escalators, moving sidewalks, just being production lined past in their dressing gowns.
Yeah,
there's almost a balletic quality to it.
Yeah, it is well crafted. I mean, and there's some well beautifully constructed shots. You know, the director's got an eye for a shot.
Oh, definitely.
And Steve, we should mention the appearance late in the film of one Jane Fonda.
Yes, what was that all about?
Well, she ties into the story of Harvey Keitel, because Harvey Keitel plays the film producer. And what we can say about Jane is she's an actress who's worked with him in the past. He wants her in this next great film, but she's coming all the way to Switzerland to have a bit of a tete-a-tete with him and, well, tell him some home truths.
And it is a quite wonderful scene.
Yeah.
Which, in many ways, didn't even need to be there. The film could have worked without it. It's almost as though somebody said, look, we've written this scene for Jane Fonda. Let's get her in, because she can deliver it magnificently. And she does.
And she did.
To be fair,
yeah.
she is superb with it. But it felt almost shoehorned in.
That's interesting. I don't know if it's tricky. I don't want to give too much away. But I would say that her appearance and the message she gives Harvey...
It's pretty powerful, yes.
It is, and doesn't that then, Steve, lead to the final act of Harvey's character?
I guess it does to a degree.
Yeah.
It is one more thing in this film which felt oddly out of place. That My big problem with the film, and I loved it, don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed it. It was a very, very interesting film with some fantastic performances. Michael Caine does subtle and understated wonderfully.
He does,
he's,
yeah.
He's sounding more and more like Bill Nighy, or possibly Bill Nighy sounding more like Michael Caine these days, I don't know.
Yeah.
And looking like Barry Cryer. But wonderful. He does a very, very understated, down-at-heel old man. You can sense the fire in his soul still. Harvey Keitel, I got the feeling, wanted to let rip and chew up the scenery, and was having to rein it in a little bit. You could tell he wanted to let go a bit more. So fantastic performances, but it felt very, very disconnected in many ways. There were too many characters who went nowhere. There was the slightly rubbish hooker in the hotel lobby. There was the masseuse who,
yes,
apparently had some sort of inner depths that we were told were there but never got to find out about. There was, again, your mystery sportsman who we won't divulge too much about. And for me, the Jane Fonda riff at the end fell within that context. It was simply another... What?
Well, so really, it's kind of almost a slice of life is a bit of a trite way to put it. But you've got two main characters, but you're just there while all these other things are playing out around them. And
yes,
as you say, they don't all interact with what the two main characters are doing.
No, not at all.
But I would certainly, I found it really, I also found it really interesting. I was wanting to see where it was going to go. It was frustrating at times, but I would certainly recommend it. Yes, it is an art house film, but you got some fantastic actors, some images that will stay with you. And
yes,
you might feel a bit confused and perplexed along the way, but hey, it's there to stimulate us and make us think. And it was fantastic in that regard.
Yeah, and let's face it, as I mentioned at the end of last week's show, you and I came out of the cinema, out of the screening, and we stood in the lobby for a good 20 minutes trying to figure out what the hell we'd just seen.
Well, if a film makes you think talk about it, that's good. It's achieved something.
It can't be an entirely bad thing.
No.
So what do we reckon? Would you buy a ticket for this?
I would. Yes, I would. I would. Yes, absolutely. And I would recommend others to do it. Yep.
Yeah, I think you'd buy a ticket at an art house. You're not going to be seeing this in the big screens. It's not going to be in IMAX.
No.
But definitely, if you get a chance, go and see it.
Good stuff. Now, Steve, I want to mention another film this week. You haven't seen it, but I'd be interested to know what you make of this. This was a film called In the Heart of the Sea.
Right.
Now, it's directed by Ron Howard. He's been around traps a while, and he can produce a good Hollywood movie. This is the story... I'll take this slowly now. This is the story of the book called In the Heart of the Sea. It was written by a guy who wanted to find out what had happened to a whaling ship called the Essex, which in the early 1820s, at a time when Nantucket, the island of Nantucket, was the center of the whaling world.
It was also a very large part of the world's limerick industry, I believe, as well.
Apparently so, yes. I'm not sure, that doesn't crop up in this film. But anyway, this film tells the story of the ship, the Essex, which went way, way out into the middle of the Pacific searching for whales and was actually hit by a sperm whale and sank.
Oh, wow.
And that true story became the basis for Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Now, I don't know about you. I know there were some movies made about Moby Dick in film history, and I've often wondered, with the CGI technology being what it is this day, would they ever do a remake and really make it look fantastically natural, and you'd really feel like there was a whale actually attacking a ship? And I saw the trailer for this, Steve, and I thought, oh, man, this is it looks pretty good. You know, they've done a great job. The thing is, if you've seen the trailer and you've got in your mind Moby Dick, you may have a few challenges in this film. It's a storytelling challenge, because the attack on the whale is not the end of the story. And it's a hugely climactic scene, right? Obviously. But it's what happened afterwards, which is also a really important part of this ship, the Essex, because the crew abandon the ship, it's sinking, they get into lifeboats, and they have to survive for weeks and weeks and weeks at sea before they're eventually found. Many of them die. And so it's a real survival tale. And I guess the tricky part for making a big budget movie is how do you sustain that part of the story when probably most people just want to see the whale?
Well, it depends. I mean, we know that a film has to follow a certain progression, doesn't it? And the big climactic scene, the battle it might be, or the explosion, or the big tense climactic thing, whatever it might be. In this case, it's going to be the whale attack. Mm. That's the climax. Everyone knows that. Where do you go after that?
Well, what they have to do is, and what they try, Ron Howe tries to do is to turn it then into a tale of human endurance and the like. But really, there's two stories there, and so I thought, I mean, it was very well produced. They really took you back. They must have done a massive amount of research into producing what a whaling ship looked like, and they take you back into the world of Nantucket. So it has a really authentic look about it. The way they depict the whale is amazing. I think they've overdone it, though. Interestingly, that Herman Melville created a piece of fiction about a whale attack, but the way they depict the whale attack, it's almost of Moby Dick style proportions.
Right.
So you might as well have told a Moby Dick story. I thought it was good, but you're just going to have to make a real big mental shift as you're watching the film to go from the absolute drama of a massive whale attacking a ship, and then you move into another type of story. So, it's a good-looking film, but it's kind of a big ask for in some ways, I think.
Well, it brings to mind, I don't know if you saw this one a couple of years ago, quite brilliant film called Captain Phillips.
Yes, 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 yes.
And if you remember, I mean, obviously, the boat comparison is obvious, but if you remember in that film, the huge complication came somewhat early in the film. And then in many ways the tone of the film and the focus and the emphasis of the film switch to whether or not the captain will survive in the clutches of the pirates. And it's almost as though, well, we've had the big dramatic thing now.
Yes.
So the film should be over, because that's how films work. That's the traditional conventional structure. But the film, I thought, certainly in the case of Captain Phillips, was so well done that you just bought into it. Does it work in the same way in this case?
I didn't know. I saw Captain Phillips on it. That was Paul Greengrass was the director
of
that
one,
wasn't
correct.
It? And he's got a great sort of visual style, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And I thought Captain Phillips worked better.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't say don't buy a ticket for it, but I would just say it may not quite be what you're expecting. That's all.
I think one of the challenges that Ron Howard and especially his marketing people are going to have with a film like this, surely, is you can't sell this film without reference to Moby Dick.
No.
But it's not Moby Dick.
No. And I think it might not, I mean, not that the money making, whether or not it makes money is the be all and end all. I suspect it may not be that commercially successful.
Yes.
Well, I think word of mouth might get around and say, actually, it's not Moby Dick. And, that might, I'd be very happy to be proved wrong.
Fair enough. Yeah, because I'm trying to imagine, what do you put on the poster for this? You know Moby Dick? Well, it's not that. It's not really. you can't sell a film on those terms, can you?
No.
But it sounds almost like that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah.
So I believe it's playing at my local independent cinema in Pukekohe, which I do think I ought to promote every now and then, because I love the fact that we have a local independent cinema
great.
In town.
Yeah.
And so I believe Pukekohe Cinema 3 do actually have a showing this week. Do I buy a ticket?
Well, you know what? Just for because we're such, I would actually be interested for you to see it and then to hear what you have to think about it. Can you go on a cheap Tuesday or something?
Yeah, we're dedicated, but we're not that dedicated. I will do that, and I will feed. I will report back this time next week.
Yeah, and I'm very happy for you to disagree with me, Mr. McKay. But
you're on,
right.
Mr. Mercer.
Right. Now, we should, but this is Crave, by the way, Steve McCabe and Simon Mercer with you. This is our podcast about the entertainment world. We've been dealing with film. Let's move on to some music. Now, first of all, Steve, last time you were looking ahead with some anticipation, I recall, to a night out at a musical piece called Jesus Christ Part 2.
Now, the fact, How- that, the fact that you're struggling to describe it pretty much tells
yes,
us,
I know.
Sets up, I was about to say the problem, and that's the wrong word. Yes, Jesus Christ Part 2 is the Basement Theatre's Christmas production. And if you remember last week, we had an interview with Gareth Williams, who's the creator of the show. He's also one of the stars of it. And I went last Friday and had a lovely time.
Glad to hear it.
It is absolutely superb. The basic premise, such as it is, and it's a weak and flimsy premise to be sure, but but it's a frame upon which a lot of other really cool stuff is hung. And the idea is that that God, the Christian God, isn't keeping up his end of the bargain in heaven, and so the CEO of heaven, who's named Yvonne, tells him that he needs to get his numbers up, and so he thinks maybe I should have a rapture. I know, I'll send my boy down. To see if he can get numbers up, or do I need to actually do a rapture? And so you've got, as I say, Gareth Williams as a number of different characters. Julian Wilson, who plays, among other things, God, sends yes. his son, that's not entirely fair. There's a rotating cast of a couple of different actors who play Jesus.
Right.
And the night that Debbie and I went, it was Madeline Sammy, who you may remember
yes,
from Super
yes.
City.
Yeah, yes.
She was Jesus.
Okay. Well, she's a very accomplished actress.
She's good
at playing, inhabiting different roles.
Well, the brilliant gimmick that they came up with for this show is that she knew who she was playing, but she knew nothing else about the show. And so the entire thing is improvised.
Okay.
The company, the four actors in the company are tightly scripted. It's a very, very well put together little piece for those four. Gareth Williams, for example, plays all 12 disciples.
Oh, right,
at
okay.
the same time.
Oh, bro. I'd
seriously.
Like to see that.
Oh, it's worth seeing just for that, to be honest.
Does he run around the stage and sit in different positions, or does this
not giving it away. You have to see it.
Okay,
you absolutely have to see it. It's very, very good. We got Hayley Spruill, who plays various different characters quite wonderfully. She, for my money, was the star of the show. Victoria Abbott, the four of them are the company for the show. And their part is very, very tightly done. They know, obviously, exactly what's coming. But the whoever's playing Jesus... just has things thrown at them completely unexpected, and they just have to roll with it.
That's a really interesting premise.
It's
wow.
very, very well done. There's a little bit, I won't go into too much detail, but there is a little bit of audience participation that works very, very well. It's the Basement Theatre. I'm sure you've been there. It's a very, very small space.
Yeah.
Which means that at one point, Gareth Williams, who, as I said, I interviewed a week earlier, was looking me straight in the eye, recognised me, and gave me a thumbs up.
He, nice. This
is how close you are. You could reach out and touch if you felt so moved. You'd probably get a slap, but you could if you were so inclined, reach out and touch the cast. It's bizarre. It's profoundly blasphemous.
Okay. Sorry, Steve. How much music actually is there in it?
Oh, there's a few songs.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
About half a dozen actual original numbers, which very, very closely, William said that parodies. It's a very tight pastiche of Jesus Christ Superstar. I'm quite familiar with the music from that show, so I could recognise individual songs. And I could figure out exactly which ones they're riffing on.
Yeah.
So there, but it's not a it's a play with a few songs. It's not a musical, and the dialogue is hysterically funny.
Oh, good. Okay, that sounds fantastic.
It's definitely worth seeing. And I'll just mention that it opened, I think I was actually on there on the very first night, on the 27th of November. It's playing, I think it's on every night of the week, except possibly
okay.
Sundays, between now and the 20th of December.
Ooh, well, I think I should maybe make a sterling effort to get along there.
I would recommend it.
If
you are easily religiously offended, do not go. Absolutely do not go.
Okay.
But oddly enough, the theology is actually hard to argue with in many places, I have to tell you. But
okay.
But it, to be absolutely blunt, though, a lot of it does depend on the caliber of the actor who's playing Jesus any given night. So yeah. I don't know who else has been on. I don't know if, say, Antonia Preble or Guy Montgomery or Lucy Lawless has done their stint yet. These are all Amanda Billing, Rose Matafeo, Hamish Parkinson. These are all people who are on the rotating list of Jesus's. And to a degree, it stands and falls to a degree on the improbability of the Jesus. And unfortunately, Madeline Sammy, while she is a very, very engaging stage presence, I'm not completely convinced she's the best improv actor in the world. That was, for me, a slight weakness. But she, the woman has an awful lot of stage charm. She really does. And that went a long way to making up for it.
Oh, good stuff. Okay, fantastic.
Definitely worth a look.
Now, what's definitely not a look, this judging by the tone in your voice at the beginning of our podcast, Steve, was Mr. Thurston Moore.
Yes, there's a bit of a story to tell here. I was asked by one of the other outlets I review for that to diplomatically put, get myself along to the Tuning Fork in Auckland on Thursday evening to review Thurston Moore. Now, I didn't know a huge amount about the bloke, but
no, I don't think I do either, to be honest.
He was in Sonic Youth, who were a sort of a post-punk pre-grunge band back in the 90s. They sort of paved the way for people like Nirvana.
Okay.
And I thought, yeah, obviously a significant part of the history of rock music, mm-hmm. I'll go and give him a look.
Yeah.
And I dutifully showed up. And within half an hour, desperately wished I hadn't.
Oh, dear.
To me, it was absolute rubbish. The first 5 minutes was simply spent doing a bit of low-level feedback out of amplifiers. It was not good. A friend of mine who was shooting the show for yet another publication, on the way out, I saw her ducking out after about 15 minutes, and I said, you're bailing out already. She said, he's been playing the same chord for the last 10 straight minutes.
Oh, dear.
And I thought, yeah, he actually has, hasn't he? And this went on for about an hour until I finally just walked out. And that's not something I do very often. I don't think I've ever done a concert before. So the concert itself was poo. It really was. There's no two ways about it. Emperor had no clothes. I'm sorry. It was absolute rubbish.
But if people knew him, would they have come along expecting to hear him play one chord for 10 minutes? Is that what they wanted?
Well, apparently, yes, it was. So I wrote my review.
Yeah.
And this is the great joy of the internet now. Everyone's allowed an opinion and a comment.
Yeah.
And the consensus is that I have no business reviewing music any longer, apparently.
Oh, dear.
But it occurred to me that the bottom line is you should never, ever criticise anybody's favourite band.
Of course. Yes. People's skins are thin sometimes.
Well, they are when you're talking about their favourite band.
Yeah.
And I've run into this before when I try to be as balanced as I can. I ran into something similar. We talked about 10cc last week.
Yes, yeah.
And I gave it, when I wrote a review for the same other outlet, I wrote a review, and I was generally quite positive.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find some things which could be critical, and I think that's part of a reviewer's job.
Yeah,
you can't just go in and say, oh my god, it's the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, because then you've got nothing to work off if it's only ever positive.
No one's gonna take you seriously, but sure. I had the temerity to criticize. How dare I?
Oh, good on you. Hey, actually, just quickly on that, Steve, the other thing that can happen, I don't know whether you, and this happens to you because you've done this a bit more than me, you can have an initial impression of an artist, right, or a performance, and then it can sit with you for a few days or weeks, and then maybe you start to reflect and you start to your views might start to shift a little bit. I mean, that's happened to me over the last week, because a week ago I spoke about the new album from Adele.
Yes.
And I thought, I think I said I was generally, you know, she's a good, amazing singer, but I had a few issues with it. I felt there's the heartbreak, broken relationship thing was laid on yet again, and I felt that story was a bit overtold. And I just thought there were maybe one or two more of those big piano-based ballads there.
Yes.
But there were still some great songs in it. I have to say, I have on occasion during the week been in the vehicle, in the car, and I've been playing it. And I do like it more than I did a week ago. And it's mainly because she just has such an engaging voice.
Yeah.
But, and this is an interesting point, I still would take at least two, maybe three songs off the album, mm-hmm. and I reckon you'd end up with a better album. And I actually want, do you ever think that? You think you get an album which might be 11, 12, 13 songs long, and you think, man, if it was 9 or 10 songs, it'd be all the better for it.
If they were still recording for a 45-minute piece of vinyl rather than a 74-minute CD.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting that you, with a record, you have the luxury of revisiting it and starting to explore it.
Yes.
And you can go back and you can find the details that sometimes take a while to reveal yourselves. Concerts don't offer you that luxury. Mercifully, I've never had to revisit Thurston Moore.
Okay, look, we're let's talk about another concert. One more. I went to this just last night.
Yes, is this a more positive review?
It is, yeah. And actually,
you're not about to criticise someone's favourite band, because that'll get you in trouble, you know.
I know. Well, there might be a bit of criticism, but hey, we've got broad shoulders. Look, I went to the Auckland Town Hall and saw two artists. The first was, this was part of the Gin Wigmore tour, promoting her latest album, Blood to the Bone. And she was the main act, but a support act was a pretty decent support act, Tammy Nielsen, the Canadian-born but very much New Zealand-based country blues soul singer who's won a swag of local music awards.
And this is a name I've heard you mention more than once before now.
Yeah, well, I reviewed her latest album just a week or two back.
Yeah, you've been championing her a bit, haven't you?
Yeah, I have, and it was actually as a result of that album, I thought, I might go along and see what she's like live. Hear this big, powerful voice in person. But she did a very short, only half-hour set to start with. It was interesting. She, again, this is all about taste, isn't it? She had a very, had a three-piece backing band. She was dressed in sort of tight 50s glam style dress and hair done up, and the guys all had white shirts and thin black ties. It had a sort of a nightclubby cabaret feel to it. Mm-hmm. But man, she's kind of got an Adele powerful style voice going, has Tammy Nielsen.
Now that's high praise indeed.
Well, she can really belt it out, and it seems effortless.
Ooh.
If I said that right, effortless.
Yeah, we'll take it.
Okay. It's not going to be everyone's cup of tea because it has got that, you know, not everyone's into country, but she is definitely singing some other style, a bit of bluesy stuff, a bit of soul stuff, sort of a Latin song there. What I would say is she has a voice which you would think could tackle just about any musical genre. I really enjoyed it. Half an hour whizzed by, and I could have heard a few more songs, to be honest with you.
Wow.
I would see her again. I would, because I just think she's got a really great voice. It's a little bit theatrical, and may not be to everyone's taste, but I liked it. Now, Gin Wigmore, how familiar are you with Gin Wigmore's music, Steve?
I live in New Zealand. It's hard to escape.
Yeah, yeah. So she's been off New Zealand's shores for a while, living in the States.
She has. She's been recording in Los Angeles, I believe.
Yeah. So she's brought this band back, which I think is mostly American. And it's a pretty big band, two guitarists plus keyboards, bass and drums, and a drummer who belts the hell out of his drum kit. And then Gin was joining in with her own drums on the front of stage and some guitar. It was big, big sound, big, rocky, powerful sound. She had some absolute big fans there. That she made a huge play of this being, you know, coming back to her hometown. The audience lapped it up, got massive applause all the way through. One of the interesting things about this, she put on a good show, quite a well choreographed show. She mm-hmm. almost had a few dance moves going there, played off the guitarists really well. And this is the interesting thing. Do you remember those early the photos you would have seen of her in the past, Steve? The kind of looking, lots of heavy eye makeup and tats. So you want to know what that spoke to you of? Did it seem like a bit of a hard, cold image, perhaps? Or
yes,
what?
And yet when she opens her mouth, it's somewhat incongruous, isn't it? There's a bit of a disconnect there.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing was, I had that image in my mind, those black and white photos of her looking, you know, sort of someone who's seen the hard side of life.
Yes.
She was bouncing around the stage and smiling and giggling and effervescently, obviously lapping up the fact she was back home. But it was Yeah, it was slightly incongruous in that it wasn't quite what I was expecting. What I did enjoy was heard her voice, that well-known sort of raspy voice. It's actually quite powerful live.
I was going to ask about that. I was wondering, yeah. I mean, on record, it's an instrument in itself, yeah, on the records. Yeah. How well does it translate to the stage?
Actually, I thought in the mix, the way that, because there's a big sound going on with the band, she had to actually kind of belt it out quite a bit. And some of that sort of raspiness she has to just sing above that and right. actually belt it out. So she's actually, on some of the quieter moments, you get some of that more distinctive flavor to the voice come through. Yes. But she actually, I thought, yeah, she had quite a powerful voice. And a very strong set, knew what she was doing, really in command of the stage, relaxed at the stage, I guess, working over in the States. I guess she's doing, I don't know how many shows she's doing, but she looked like someone who's been honing her craft on stage.
Right.
And I think if you're not familiar with her music, and I'm not hugely familiar with her music, this might be a blasphemous thing to say.
Say it.
I would possibly, I feel like I've seen that Jen Wigmore set. I feel I know what she's about. And I wouldn't necessarily rush back to see her again, not in a hurry. Whereas, and this might be my bias, Tammy Nielsen, because I think she just does such a wide range of stuff,
mm-hmm.
I would probably more quickly go back and see her sing again, because I'd like to see her tackle other sorts of songs because of the nature of her voice. That's just a little personal.
Now, do you see her? There. I mean, I think I know the answer to this question already, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you see her having the legs and the stage presence and the songwriting chops to transition from support act? Do you see her being a headliner?
I think that she does, but I don't know whether. I had this feeling that maybe New Zealand isn't the right place for her.
Right.
But she is from North America originally. And I don't know, I just kind of wondered whether her best audience is in Canada and the United States. I'm not sure about that.
To be fair, even her name screams Nashville, doesn't it?
It does, Tammy Nielsen. Yeah.
There's no escaping that. So
yeah.
So maybe there is a future for her, and maybe it's not on these shores.
Yeah, just a wee thought that crossed my mind. Anyway, it was a good night out. Two really good performances, great bands, people were into it, and good to hear some local music for sure.
Glad to hear it. Now, speaking of music, next week is looking like quite a busy week, potentially. If things play out the way I'm hoping they will, next time we should be looking at Ed Sheeran, is one of the hot tickets.
Ooh, now that's fantastic.
Yes, he's at
fantastic. All right,
Western Spring Stadium.
Have you got a second ticket there?
Working on it, okay. Sir. Working on it. He's going to be playing at, interestingly enough, Western Spring Stadium.
Now that is interesting because, of course, that can handle a massive crowd.
Yes, and it's going to be one man and a guitar.
Holy smoke!
I'd very much like to get hold of a ticket for that one.
Yeah,
because it'd be fascinating to see how well one man and a guitar can fill. I mean, this is where you expect to see the likes of the Rolling Stones or, dare I say it, Bruce Springsteen.
That's you dare.
That's the size of show that you expect to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know. This is the start of the big rock concert season. We had Fleetwood Mac here a couple of weeks ago, and these are the kind of people you expect to see doing the stadium gigs. I'd be fascinated to see how well he can pull off a stadium show. My daughter, who's a huge fan, just laughs at any suggestion that he won't be anything but brilliant. but we shall see. And then it's looking like a couple of days after that, once they've cleared the stage away from him, same venue, AC/DC are coming to town.
Holy, now that's the sort of band you expect to see at Western Springs.
It is rather, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
That's a west of Auckland band right there, isn't it?
It is. You have to wear a black T-shirt and be riding a motorcycle to attend that concert, Steve.
I'm growing my mullet out already.
Okay. It'll be a huge crowd. Massive.
Yes, it will. So we'll see. We'll see how it all works out. We hope to have some reviews of those two next week. In terms of films, slim pickings next week, unfortunately. The only one I've got definitely boxed off for next week is something called Daddy's Home. which looks... We don't prejudge films, do we?
No, absolutely not.
Just as well, really, because this one's dreadful.
Okay, right. Whew. Okay, but anyways, a musical tour de force is in store, we hope.
That's the plan.
Good stuff. All right. Hey, well, that's been Crave. Good to talk to you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, or you can track us down on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @CravePodcast.
So I'm Simon Mercier.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.